Last time we finished chapter 20 of the book of Acts, and this time we'll go right on into chapter 21. You will recall that Paul had gathered the Ephesian elders to himself. He wanted to give them one final bit of instruction, something that he reminded them that he did not cease for the whole period of time he had been with them to tell them about, and that is that false teachers would be coming their way and even arise from their own midst, meaning in the ministry itself. So this is something he cautioned them about, and we took a look at that, what happened to the Ephesian church. And it seems that they did pretty much follow Paul's instructions. We read about them in the book of Revelation, the church of Ephesus, and how they did withstand those who came with false doctrines, and how they recognized the false apostles, and how they did not receive their teachings. But then, of course, they had begun to lose their first love, and that means they were opening the door to possible apostasy. But in chapter 21, we move right on now. I remember that Paul wanted to get with them because the Ephesian elders knew he would not be going back there again to visit with them, and because he was on his way to Jerusalem. And you will recall that we were told in chapter 20 that everywhere he went in Asia Minor, he was warned. He was told. There was revelation came by way of the Holy Spirit to the various individuals in the congregations, prophets, that he would have problems at Jerusalem. And yet we also saw in chapter 20 that it was the Spirit that inspired Paul to go to Jerusalem. So there's no contradiction here. By going to Jerusalem, Paul wasn't disobeying the Spirit. He wasn't disobeying God, what God was revealing through the Spirit. He told Paul to go, so Paul was going. At the same time, he gave multiple witness to the fact that he would encounter some serious problems when he got to Jerusalem. So he knew what he was walking into, and he insisted on going anyway because he knew that God wanted him to go. So here we are in chapter 21, verse 1. And when we had parted from them and set sail, we came by straight course to Kos. This was an island located about 2.5 miles off the coast of Asia Minor, which is modern-day Turkey. And the next day to Rhodes, that's an island located some 12 miles off the coast of Asia Minor. And from there to Patara, that's southwest, on the southwest coast of Asia Minor. And having found a ship crossing to Phoenicia, that's he's going all the way over to the Phoenician coastline. That's where you find Tyre and some of those other coastal cities there. And having found a ship crossing to Phoenicia, we went aboard and set sail. When we had come in sight of Cyprus, that's the island out in the Mediterranean there, as they're passing by, they see it off to the left. Leaving it on the left, we sailed to Syria and landed at Tyre. So that's their destination. For there, the ship was to unload its cargo. And that's about a 400-mile journey across the Mediterranean Sea. Verse 4, and having sought out the disciples, we stayed there for 7 days. Now, where did these disciples come from? They're in the place called Tyre. It's a Phoenician, in the Phoenician region. So where do you suppose they came from? Well, a church had been established in Tyre through the witness of those who were, you remember back in Acts chapter 11, those who were scattered as a result of the persecution brought on by this guy, same guy who's now meeting with these people. Well, Stephen went up there. Remember chapter 11, verse 19, the book of Acts. Now those who were scattered because of the persecution that arose over Stephen traveled as far as Phoenicia. I said Stephen, Philip went there. But those who were scattered because of the persecution that arose over Stephen, remember when Stephen was martyred, traveled as far as Phoenicia, this region here, Cyprus and Antioch, all the way up to Antioch, speaking the word to no one except Jews. These people who were scattered were Jewish. They were, as we talked about it back then, they were the Grecian Jews, because those were the ones that primarily targeted by this persecution. Continuing on, and through the Spirit, there it is again, as in chapter 20, through the Spirit they were telling Paul not to go on to Jerusalem. Once again, this revelation came to these people, just as it had to many in Asia Minor. Every place he went in Asia Minor, in other regions there, he was told this. And here now he's in Tyre, and they're telling them the same thing there. So again, Paul was not rejecting a warning that was given through divine revelation. He was actually obeying an instruction that he received through the Spirit to go to Jerusalem. The Spirit was simply revealing what lay ahead in store for Paul, but quite naturally his friends. It was his friends and his fellow disciples who didn't want him to go. They urged him not to. They knew what was going to happen. Now, this brings up a subject, talking about all these revelations coming by way of the Spirit. Some people will ask, well, why isn't that happening here today with us? How many of you received, maybe you shouldn't answer that question. I was going to say, how many of you received revelation of the Spirit this week? But, you know, sometimes you have people who raise their hand and claim that they did. But in any case, why don't you have that going on? This introduces a subject. It's a very controversial one. You have two sides of this. One view is called cessationism, and the other view is called continuationism. The continuationists say the gifts are for today. They're still being exercised, still being given today. People still speaking in tongues, have the gifts of healing, have the gifts of prophecy, have the gifts of working miracles, all kinds of things like that are still going on. The cessationists say, no. Those things served as a witness to Jesus, his resurrection, and to the apostolic ministry, but once the faith was delivered, and then put in writing, in the form of the New Testament documents, it was all complete. And so the work of the Spirit was done in that regard, not completely. I mean, there are other works, there are other things the Spirit accomplishes. But so therefore, the gifts, those particular gifts associated with the ministry of Jesus and of the apostles, ceased. So they're called cessationists. A lot of people in the Reformed churches believe that. The Stone Campbell Restoration Movement, from which this denomination owns this building, came. The independent churches of Christ and Christian churches from that movement, most of them are cessationists, believing that once the Scripture was inspired, then the gifts of the Spirit ceased to be given. Now, I don't fully agree with either view, but both sides have some good points. First of all, we do know, because Scripture tells us, that the gifts were, that particular miracles were performed in order to serve as a witness to the truth of the apostolic teaching. No question about that. No question about the fact that in the ministry of Jesus, miracles were extraordinary, far more. There were far more than at any other time in history up to that point, because they served as a witness to Jesus' messiahship. He said, if you don't believe me, just believe me for my work's sake. In other words, look at what is being done here. You see the evidence. You see the proof that I am the Messiah. And the same thing with the apostles. But so that's a valid point. However, just because the gifts of the Spirit were given to accomplish that work, the foundational work, preparing the New Testament, laying the foundation for the New Testament church, just because the Spirit gave special gifts for the accomplishment of that work, does that necessarily mean that the Spirit is never going to have a special work again? No, doesn't mean that at all. On the continuationist side, the problem with that view, in my estimation, is that the people who are involved in it tend to think that they are in control of the gifts. In other words, if we'll meet long enough, hold our hands high enough, repeat prayers often enough, and get ourselves worked up through various techniques, then somehow we can, what do? They wouldn't use the expression manipulate God, but that's, isn't that kind of what they're trying to do? To get him to give these gifts, and they think that somehow they're in control of it. No, the way I read it, my understanding of it is, and I think it's scriptural, is that that's entirely up to God. And so many times when people receive the gifts, they were not expecting it. It's just something that happened to them. They weren't practicing some special techniques, you know, getting in the lotus position and doing, you know, special Eastern meditative techniques or anything like that. In order to get God to give them gifts. No, it just happens to them. In fact, let's take a look just very briefly at 1 Corinthians chapter 12. 1 Corinthians, the 12th chapter that talks about these spiritual gifts, and it's evident that they were being given in abundance during those days. But in chapter 12, the Apostle Paul says, now in verse 1, "Now concerning spiritual gifts, brothers, I do not want you to be uninformed." I'm using the English Standard Version today, if it differs from yours a little bit. "You know that when you were pagans, you were led astray to mute idols, however you were led. Therefore, I want you to understand that no one speaking in the Spirit of God ever says Jesus is accursed," and so on. He says, look, verse 4, "Now there are varieties of gifts, but the same Spirit." Get this? The same Spirit. "Still, there are varieties of service, but the same Lord. And there are varieties of activities, but it is the same God who empowers them all in everyone," meaning everyone, talking about the church, not every human being on the face of the earth. "To each is given the manifestation of the Spirit for the common good." In other words, it's not to show off or anything like that. It's given, whatever that gift is, whatever that particular gift is, it's given for the common good. "To one is given the Spirit, the utterance of wisdom, and of another," not the same one, somebody else, "the utterance of knowledge," according to the same Spirit. One Spirit, but here you have two different gifts. We won't take the time to discuss what different things mean, but nevertheless, the point is these are gifts of the Spirit. "To another, faith," not the faith that saves, this is a special faith, "by the same Spirit. To another, gifts of healing, by the one Spirit. To another, the working of miracles. To another, prophecy. To another, the ability to distinguish between spirits. To another, various kinds of tongues. To another, the interpretation of tongues. All these are empowered by one and the same Spirit, who apportions to each one individually." Here's the key, right here. "As he wills." As who wills? The people? Yeah, God, as God wills. The Spirit gives these gifts. And then he goes on a little bit further. Let me skip on over to verse 27. "Now you are the body of Christ and individual members of it. And God has appointed," here's some of these things that God has done. "God has appointed in the church first apostles, second prophets, third teachers, then miracles, then gifts of healing, helping, administering, and various kinds of tongues." So here these are things the Spirit, God does through the Spirit, okay? And again, it is as He wills, not as we will, right? Did Jesus say, "You chose me, I didn't choose you," to the apostles? No. He said, "I chose you, you didn't choose me." He says, "Are all apostles?" His answer in the backdrop is not, yes. You know, some people today think, I guess they think we are. Well, we're all, the word means one sent. We're all sent, aren't we? No, not in the sense in which Paul means it here. "Are all apostles?" The answer, of course, is no. "Are all prophets?" No. "Are all teachers?" No. How do you get to be these things? Do you go into a monastery and live on bread and water, one meal a day for 5 or 6 years, practice asceticism until finally you get something? No. You know, God will give them where He wants to. It's up to Him entirely. Do all work miracles? No. Do all possess gifts of healing? No, is the answer. Do all speak with tongues? No. Do all interpret? Nope. But earnestly desire the higher gifts. And then he goes on to show a better way. That goes into 1 Corinthians 13. We won't go there today. But the point here is that it is up to God to give gifts. Which gift he gives, or gifts, in a particular time, is entirely up to him. And I would say that, as I've already said, but I've said again, that when gifts are given, and I don't know what the church of the rest of the world is doing. You know, we live in our world. We live here. But there are people around the world. It's a pretty big world. And we don't know what the Spirit is doing in other places. And but the point is that if the time comes, and there's some evidence that the time will come, if you look at Joel's prophecy, I don't think it was exhausted in the days of the apostles. I expect that it will still be, there's still fulfillment to be done in the last days. So it seems to me that once again there will be an outpouring of the Spirit and accompanying miracles at that time as a final witness to the world before the end comes. And when that time comes, then it'll be up to God to give the gifts to whomsoever he will. Okay, so there are certain good points in cessationism and certain good points in continuationism. But the bottom line is it's up to God. Just depend on him. He'll give the gifts as he sees fit and as they are needed. Now to verse 5, back to the book of Acts. Verse 5, continuing on. It says, when our days there were ended, we departed and went on our journey. And they all, with wives and children, accompanied us until we were outside the city. And kneeling down on the beach, we prayed and said farewell to one another. Then we went on aboard the ship, and they returned home. When we had finished the voyage from Tyre, we arrived at Ptolemais. That's 25 miles south of Tyre. So they took, rather than just walk down the coast, they, or travel, you know, by foot some way, or some way on land, they went by boat 25 miles down the coast. They said going up to Jerusalem because Jerusalem was higher elevation. But we look at a map, you say, well, they were going down to Jerusalem. We think in north and south terminology. But 25 miles south of Tyre on the coast is where they went. And we greeted the brothers and stayed with them for one day. On the next day, we departed and came to Caesarea. That's 32 miles south of Ptolemais. And we entered the house of Philip the Evangelist. Now, this brings up another topic. In fact, we're going to run into a couple of topics here, one of which is rather controversial. Now, I'll step into that minefield in just a little while. But first of all, notice it says Philip the Evangelist, who was one of the seven. What's he talking about, one of the seven? Remember that? And stayed with him. Back in Acts chapter 6, he was one of those appointed to manage the food distribution to the widows. Remember that? One of those seven. We refer to him as these as deacons. So he was a deacon. But yet it says he was an evangelist. Remember, he was the same guy who also, he was among those Hellenist Jews who were dispersed after the death of Stephen. We mentioned that a little while ago. And he was also the one who went to Samaria, proclaimed the good news there. Remember his encounter with Simon Magus. Also, he proclaimed the gospel to the Ethiopian eunuch. We talked about that some chapters back. And he baptized him. And now he proclaims he and others that were scattered proclaimed the good news to the peoples along the coast of the Phoenician coast, all the way up to Antioch. Now then, it says Philip the Evangelist. We first encountered him as Philip the Deacon. Does that mean he moved up in rank? That's a kind of a controversial subject in some quarters. I don't think it is with us. But the fact is, you know, a lot of people, I remember the old days, some of you didn't have the experience of the Worldwide Church of God days. But back in those days, they somehow or other it developed over time. I don't know how exactly it did it, but in any case, obviously there comes to be a need as congregations grow and the ministry, is needed. And as you have more and more ministers, after a while you need to have different functions within the ministry. That's just natural. Just like if you have a board, you have a chairman of the board and other functions on the board. Well, they started naming different functions. Like there's one, like the leading minister simply is a pastor. I think they used the title back in those days, preaching elder. So you had, it ended up with this. You had a local elder. And we always heard the expression local church elder. That was below a local elder. But I think some places they call them local elders. So you have a local or local church elder, a local elder, then the preaching elder, and then you move on up to evangelist rank. That's on up there. Of course, the very top is reserved for just one, and that's an apostle. But in any case, that was the hierarchy that they'd worked out in those days. But the truth of the matter is that when it says Philip the evangelist, it simply means that God had gifted him with the ability to proclaim the good news effectively. You see, that's what he began doing right away when he was among those scattered. He went to Samaria. He proclaimed good news there, and he was effective. He went into his own country there, in Tyre, went into other, and perhaps even north of there. And so he got a reputation for being Philip, the proclaimer of glad tidings. That's what it means. So it is a function, not a rank. A function, not a rank. Just wanted to mention that in passing. These are functions, not ranks. We have, in the church, we have two offices. In Scripture, you can support two offices. But these other functions are not really, technically speaking, are not offices. You have the office of elder and the office of deacon. Elder, also called many other things, bishop, shepherd, different words that are used. Overseer is the word that, translated that bishop means. It really means overseer. And later on, I think probably about sometime in the second century or thereabouts, the term bishop came to be used in reference to the leading elder. But early on, these words were used interchangeably. They were just different words to describe a single office. The office of overseer or shepherd or elder or whatever you want to use. These were ordinary terms, but they were used to describe a particular office. And the other was deacon, which simply means servants. Now, we're all servants in one sense. But in the sense in which it means in Scripture, when Paul talks to Timothy about the qualifications for bishops or overseers and deacons, he has a particular office in mind. Now, verse 9, here's where the minefield lies. He, meaning Philip, had four unmarried daughters who prophesied. Uh-oh. Where do you think they prophesied? Where did they do their prophesying? At home? By themselves? Presumably they had the gift of prophecy. It was a gift that they had. We have seen that people had gifts. And here you have four women who have gifts of prophecy. Prophecy involves what? Speaking, doesn't it? Where'd they do their speaking? In church, right? Church services? That's where they did their speaking. But didn't Paul say in 1 Timothy chapter 2 and in verses 11 through 14, let a woman learn quietly and with all submissiveness? I do not permit a woman to teach or to exercise authority over a man. Rather, she is to remain silent. For Adam was formed first, then Eve. And Adam was not deceived, but the woman was deceived and became a transgressor. So here he says, let a woman remain quiet. Now this has context to it. Remember, Paul was writing to Timothy when he wrote that. And what was he writing to Timothy about? order in the church in Ephesus, right? Yep, he left him in Ephesus. He wanted to keep things in order there. He wanted to guard against, as he mentions in the first epistle to Timothy, he wanted him to guard against false teaching that he knew would be coming there. That's first and foremost. But he also wanted to set things in order. Okay, so he gives Timothy instructions. As you see right away, right after this verse I just read, he starts talking about overseers and deacons. So what does this speaking have? What is the context of this? I think it's pretty obvious. The context is, well, he said, notice how he puts it, I do not permit a woman to teach, revealing what the Spirit has given by way of, you know, by way of revelation. Is not necessarily teaching, is it? It's just expressing. We'll see an example of another prophet that came on the scene who had a revelation. He shared it with Paul, but he wasn't teaching Paul anything. We'll see that in just a few moments. But here, this is obviously talking about the church service itself and a certain context. It does not mean that a woman has to be silent in every context. Not the case. In fact, it doesn't necessarily mean that a woman... piano player can't correct the song leader when he's got the wrong page by hollering at him. But it has a certain context to it. Now, a lot of people say, well, no, but most churches today, most mainstream churches, not all, but most of them, ordain women into the office of overseer, elder, whatever term they call it. They're women pastors. And that's controversial in many, even some of the Sabbath-keeping groups. It's a controversy if something's being discussed. But here Paul says what he says in 1 Timothy chapter 2. And some people, I want to give you the explanation that's often given. The usual argument. Pick up most commentaries, and most of them are written by... And oh, by the way, this controversy involves two schools of thought. A couple more isms, let me give you. One is egalitarianism, and the other is complementarianism. Complementarianism says that God made the genders, and he gave them specific roles. We're not talking about superiority and inferiority here. He says, you know, we read in 1 Corinthians, what is it, chapter 11, I believe it is, where the husband is the head of the wife. And here you see the woman is not to exercise authority over the man, and he refers not to the fall, which a lot of people refer to, where it says, to you shall be his desire, and he shall rule over you. No, that's a corruption of the original order that God established. But Paul refers to the creation order itself as evidence. In other words, God doesn't do something by flipping a coin. Whatever he does is purposeful. He made Adam first. He could have made the woman first and then Adam. But he made Adam first, and this suggests headship and subordination. But remember, bone of my bones, flesh of my flesh. You can have equality and differences of function, different roles within the marriage union, can't you? And that can extend out into society. And obviously, we all know that men and women are different, aren't they? Yeah, they're different. It was my experience growing up in the school, you know, the young years growing up, going to school, that the girls were smarter than we were. They were the smart ones in the class. You know, that's because they could focus. They matured quickly. We didn't, you know, we drug along behind, but they did. They could focus on the school work that was going on at the time. And most of us, well, we could do that a little bit. Sometimes if you really put your mind to it, you could do it pretty well. A guy could, a boy, but our minds were out there on the playground. You know, we didn't focus as well. So it's not a matter of inferiority and superior, who can do the job best. That's not it. Now, I've worked in the offices with women, and they can do certain jobs way better than I could ever hope to. But on the other hand, I've also worked with women. I used to be a construction worker. You may not, it may not fit the me that you are familiar with, but I used to get up on iron. I was an iron worker. I climb those columns, run around on the steel all day long. And I could do that. And there were, once in a while, would have a woman work on the same crew. Wouldn't do exactly the same things that I did and other guys did, but they were there. And you know what? They paid me more than they paid those women. Is that because it's a male dominant sexist society? No, it's because those women couldn't do what I could do. They were women. They couldn't do it. You know, they couldn't do that kind of job. Now, I'm sure there are women who can. I know there are. But they're few and far between. So men and women are different. There's a bunch of guys, all kind of guys. They're standing in line waiting for the job, you know, who can do the same stuff. But women, few and far between. So we're just different in that regard. But it comes to other kinds of work. Well, there, you know, you usually want to hire a woman to do that. But in any case, people are different, and God assigns roles partly based, I think, on that difference that He put within the human kind, within humankind, the genders. Today, of course, a lot of people want to blur those distinctions. Not just role distinctions, but actual gender distinction, which is, that's getting way out there. But the usual argument on this particular topic here is that women in Ephesus were not educated because it was a male-dominant society and women were denied the right to learn literary skills, etc. Okay, so Paul doesn't want them teaching and exercising authority over the men because the men had more educational opportunities than they did. They weren't educated. No fault of their own. It's just the way the society was. So they weren't educated. So obviously they couldn't function well in that office. I see only one minor problem with that argument about women not being educated in Ephesus. Common argument. And that is, the problem is it's false. It's false. Let me read something to you here. Some research that's been done on that particular region, coming from even a time before Paul, and certainly extending into Paul's day. But this comes from a book, is cited in a book entitled Evangelical Feminism by Wayne Grudem, but it comes from a book, he's quoting a book entitled Women and Men in Ministry, page 281 through 283, and by the authors are Clinton Arnold and Robert Saucy, in case you want to look that up sometime. But anyway, let me read a few paragraphs out of that book. It says, in a very important recent study, now this was back in the early 90s when the book was published, I believe, 92, somewhere along in there. It says, in a very important recent study, Paul Tribilco has accumulated and presented the inscriptional evidence attesting to the role of women in civic positions in Western Asia Minor. This is right where Paul was at this point, but or was when the Ephesians, when he was talking to the Ephesians, that's where he was. There is now inscriptional evidence that women served in some of the cities in a position that would be a close functional equivalent of our superintendent of schools. Sounds educated to me, huh? That is, in the capacity of gymnasiarch. The gymnasium was the center of education in a Greek city. The gymnasiarch had oversight of the intellectual training of the citizens and for the general management of the facility. Inscriptions dating from the 1st to the 3rd centuries attest to 48 women who served as gymnasiarchs in 23 cities of Asia Minor and the coastal islands. This suggests that women not only had access to education, but also that in many places they were leading the educational system. So that argument doesn't work very well, does it? That the Ephesian women were uneducated, so that Paul didn't want them in leadership positions. Didn't have the literary skills for it. Didn't have the oratory skills for it. So let them go work in the educational field. This evidence stands in contrast to what we generally know of the plight of women at the beginning of the Roman Empire, but beginning in the late Republic, 2nd century B.C., an early imperial period. Remember, this is the transition from brought on largely by the activities of Julius Caesar when the Republic became an empire. A much greater array of opportunities opened up for women. The famous British classicist Michael Grant observed that, quote, the Roman women of the late Republic possessed a freedom and independence almost unparalleled until the present century. So, the question is, did women have educational opportunities, women of Ephesus, in the time of Paul? Answer, plenty of them. They were educated. They could read, they could write, they could exercise leadership skills, and did so quite effectively in the public education systems and in other areas of life. So Paul, when he forbids women from exercising authority, he has in mind a particular office in the church. He's not shutting down all opportunities, all times that women can speak. You know, it's interesting how that the ones who usually complain about women speaking are women. I remember back years ago when I first came into CGI, first feast site was CGI. Well, I think it was my second feast, actually. It was in Gunnersville, Alabama. And there was a lady there who was just out of a different organization, and she was all nervous. She was doing special music for her first time at a feast site. You know, of course, it's not nearly as big a feast site as the one she was used to, but here she was doing special music for the very first time, and you could hear the nervousness in her voice as she wanted to introduce the music. You know, some songs you need to tell the people what it's about. So she got up and said, this song is about a such and such and such. Just took a few moments to explain that. You know, there was not a single man in that audience who thought anything at all about that. She went on to do a very good job. Nobody thought anything about it. But afterward, after services, there's a group of women grumbling about a woman speaking up there in the pulpit. Yeah. So this is how far some people will take this kind of instruction, and it's way off base. There are contexts in which women can speak and even teach and do other things. Involvement in Bible studies and things like that, and certain involvement here in the lectern. That's it's not what Paul has in mind. But to answer the question, if you have the question, of whether I am complementarian or egalitarian, I would say complementarian. I think the two genders complement each other, and God designed it that way. That they're to be complementary, meaning each has his or her role to play. And it's not only in the family unit, but, you know, what is the church but an expanded family? It's a family. And so the same pattern is reflected in the assembly, in the church. So continuing on here, verse 10, while we were staying for many days, a prophet named Agabus came down from Judea. Keep in mind, earlier I said, should have mentioned it then, I'm going to refer you to, we'll read down to verse 12. And I want to remind you, though, of what we did read in verse 9 about the four unmarried daughters who prophesied. Now, it's interesting, it doesn't tell us what they prophesied. It just says they prophesied. They were prophetesses. But here we read about a prophet who came from Judea, whose name was Agabus, and we are told what he prophesied. And coming to us, he took Paul's belt and bound his own feet and hands and said, thus says the Holy Spirit, this is how the Jews at Jerusalem will bind the man who owns this belt and deliver him into the hands of the Gentiles. When he heard this, says Luke, we and the people there urged him not to go to Jerusalem. So I now refer you back to the four daughters. What do you suppose they were prophesying about, at least when Paul was there? Luke doesn't say, but due to the fact that he said earlier, in verse 4, for example, we read earlier, and in chapter 20, that everywhere he went, the Spirit was revealing that trouble lay ahead in Jerusalem. So, and then now you read about Agabus, and kind of between those, that statement in verse 4 and Agabus, you have these four daughters who are prophesying. I would say that Luke, it's all probability, that Luke presupposed that his readers would understand that these four daughters of Philip were prophesying concerning what would happen to Paul in Jerusalem. Isn't that a logical assumption? Verse 13, then Paul answered, "What are we doing? What are you doing, weeping and breaking my heart? For I am ready not only to be imprisoned, but even to die in Jerusalem for the name of the Lord Jesus." And since he would not be persuaded, he ceased and said, or we ceased and said, "Let the will of the Lord be done." Yeah. You know, they knew it meant, it probably means the end of Paul's life. But remember, he'd received revelation by way of the Spirit that he was to go to Jerusalem. You see that back in chapter 20. Verse 15, after these days we get ready and we got ready and went up to Jerusalem, and some of the disciples from Caesarea went with us, bringing us to the house of Mnason of Cyprus, an early disciple with whom we should lodge. When we had come to Jerusalem, the brothers received us gladly. Remember, as we discussed earlier, Paul sought to keep Pentecost in Jerusalem. His journey from Philippi to Caesarea took at least 36 days. If you go back and look at a map and do the math, look at what the text tells you about how many days there were at this place or that place. So it was at least 36 days from Philippi to Caesarea, and he spent several days at Caesarea. Now, the Pentecost means what? 50th day from the wave sheaf. So you have, remember that the Feast of Unleavened Bread was back much earlier. We read about that. So 36 days plus the extra days, several days in Caesarea, is coming up on that 50th day. So he's close. We don't know exactly how close to Pentecost. Very close, though. It was fast approaching. Verse 18, on the following day, Paul went in with us to James, and all the elders were present. Why does he single out James like this? Why didn't he just say, we went in and to see all the elders? It's because it's pretty obvious that James is singled out like this because of he's the, as we might say, chairman of the council, chairman of the board, whatever you want to call it, the presiding elder. And you see this back in Acts chapter 12, where Peter was miraculously delivered from prison and came to the believers assembled in the house of Mary, mother of John, John Mark, that is. And there he said, described to them how, as it says in the text, how the Lord had brought him out of prison. This is verse 17, Acts 12, verse 17. How the Lord brought him out of prison. And he said, tell these things to James and to the brothers. So tell these things to James and to the brothers. So even at that point, back in chapter 12, James was already looked upon as the presiding elder in Jerusalem. I bring that out because Peter wasn't the presiding elder. James was. Then he departed and went to another place. Now, also, you remember in Acts 15, when we were there, it's pretty obvious that James was the presiding elder of the Jerusalem council. After Peter spoke, Paul spoke, and Barnabas spoke, and they had much discussion. And then James said, my conclusion is, my judgment is, that we should write a letter, and then he outlined what should be written. And so it's pretty obvious he was presiding elder. So that's why James is sometimes singled out in these texts. Verse 19, after greeting them, he related one by one the things that God had done among the Gentiles through his ministry. And when they heard it, they glorified God, and they said to him, you see, brother, how many thousands there are among the Jews of those who have believed. Now this is an interesting statement here. talking about believing Jews, thousands of believing Jews, Christian Jews. They are all zealous for the law. Now, what is meant when the expression "the law" is used? You look through Paul's epistles and all other places in the New Testament, you see this expression "the law." Read about the curse of the law, being under the law, different times the word, the expression "the law" is used. Sometimes, for example, Romans chapter 7, verse 7, you remember what Paul says? He said, "I would not have known sin except the law says, you shall not covet." Well, sometimes when he says "the law," he has in mind the moral commandments, such as the Ten Commandments. But you also remember in Galatians chapter 4 and verses 2 and thereabouts, he says, "You who would be under the law, do you not hear the law?" And then he quotes from Genesis. So the law is the Torah in that case. So sometimes he has in mind the moral commandments, sometimes he has in mind the Torah, or maybe even Revelation in general. And then, as we're going to see in this case here, the ceremonial features of the law are in mind, because it comes out in the text. Verse 21. And, you know, by the way, of course, we've talked about this before, Paul was not in opposition to the law. That was the rumor. He was not. He was in opposition to imposing on people laws from the law that did not apply to them, and saying it's a salvation issue, such as circumcision, such as the ceremonial laws. And that's what was going on. But these are all zealous for the law. Now, this is the reason you can look at them and tell they're zealous for the law is, well, you can't see their hearts. You can see what they're doing externally, though. And that involved what they were doing at Jerusalem, at the temple. They were still involved in worship at the temple, offering sacrifices and participating in the ceremonial features of the law. It says, "So they're all zealous for the law, and they have been told about you that you teach all the Jews who are among the Gentiles to forsake Moses, telling them not to circumcise their children or to walk according to our customs." Now, was Paul really telling these Jewish converts that? No, what he was telling them is, don't impose some of these things on Gentiles. Verse 22, what then is to be done? They will certainly hear that you have come. So they anticipated trouble from the believing Jews, because of the rumors that had spread concerning Paul. So they came up with a plan. "Do therefore what we tell you. We have four men who are under a vow." We talked about this before. This was a Nazarite vow. These are four men, four believing Jews under a Nazarite vow. "Take these men and purify yourself along with them and pay their expenses." See, what they had to do is, when the period of the vow ended, they were to cut their hair. Cut all the hair, however long it had gotten. And they had to cut it all off, shave it, or short, make it, you know, just cut it real short, and take it and burn it when they offered the sacrifice. And of course, there was an expense involved, and Paul was to pay the expense. He's to participate with them in this ritual, or in this ceremony, and to pay the expense. He had to purify himself. That means he had to undergo the purification ceremony himself. "Thus all will know that there is nothing in what they have been told about you, and that you yourself also live in observance of the law." Now, Paul didn't object to this claim. Can you say, "Uh-oh, they were lying here"? No. He absolutely did not oppose Jews doing what Jews customarily did. He did not oppose Jews circumcising their 8-day-old male sons. He did not oppose them going to the temple, offering sacrifices according to the law. And see, this is why we know he's talking about this when he says they're zealous for the law. He has in mind the ceremonial features of the law. Because that's what he's talking about in this text. And when he talks about living in observance of the law, then he has in mind these ceremonial features of the law. So Paul did not oppose that at all. He says, then they say, this is what the elders, James and the others, said, verse 25, but as for the Gentiles who have believed, we have sent a letter with our judgment that they should abstain from what has been sacrificed to idols, and from blood, and from what has been strangled, and from sexual immorality, or porneia. Now, obviously this doesn't mean this is all they were required to do. It doesn't mean that there's no other requirements in mind. What about that mean they could just cuss all they wanted now? Blaspheme God's name. It's not mentioned here, is it? No. They could dishonor their parents. Even though the Ephesians couldn't, because Paul told them they couldn't. They'd be breaking the commandment. Ephesians 5 or 6, wherever that is. But in any case, obviously these are things that would be an issue. They only identified those things that would be in this new situation. You had Jews and Gentiles come together in fellowship, which is something unusual, and a very close bond of fellowship. And these are the things, most of these things mentioned here are the things that would prove problematic in that environment. So it was necessary for them to note these things. But there are other things, other moral features in the law. You know, all 10 of the commandments are 10 broad moral categories, and all of those were still in place, and they all knew that. They understood that very well. Verse 26, then Paul took the men, and the next day he purified himself along with them and went into the temple, giving notice that when the days of purification would be fulfilled and the offering presented for each one of them. So here he's participating in this. He's going along with it. And it's not deception, because indeed Paul was not opposed to them doing those things. Instead, he was in agreement with James and the elders that you don't impose certain things like that on Gentiles. Verse 27, when the 7 days were almost completed, the Jews from Asia, seeing him in the temple, stirred up the whole crowd and laid hands on him, crying out, "Men of Israel, help! This is the man who is teaching everyone everywhere against one, against the people." Was he? Two, and the law. Again, was he? And this place. That's number three. Now, what in the world do you suppose would have caused would have given rise to that rumor? Paul is preaching everywhere against the people, the Jewish people, against the law, and against the temple. What was he teaching that might have given this impression to somebody who then passed it on to somebody else, and by the time it got to Jerusalem, to this group of people, it was a new story, as it were. Like the game, what is it, telephone or whatever. Remember the childhood game where people, one whispers a statement to the next, to the next, to the next, and the time it gets to the end, it's very different. Well, that's what's going on here, it seems. But I would say that Paul has talked about the persecution. You see that very clearly in his epistles and also in the book of Acts, the persecution from the Jews in Judea. That's a fact. But by talking about that doesn't mean he's speaking against the people, does it? No, he's speaking about those who persecute the Christians. And he includes his former self in that category and laments the fact. The law? Well, from the point of view of the Pharisees who were believers, yeah, he was speaking against the law. Because the law, in order for a Gentile to become a member of the new covenant community, he had to become an Israelite, as it were. He had to be adopted as an Israelite through the rite of circumcision. And Paul did oppose that. To them, he was against the law. Because to them, that was the law, what the law called for, but it doesn't. And this place, you know, I have no doubt whatsoever that Paul taught the same thing that Jesus taught about that place, that not one stone would be left upon another. And he knew that the AD 70 event would come. He didn't know exactly when it would come necessarily, but he knew it would come. And no doubt he told the people about that. And to them, he's speaking against the temple then. So this is how rumors get started, you might say. Moreover, he even brought, this is still the allegation, the false charges. Moreover, he even brought Greeks into the temple and has defiled this holy place. For they had previously seen Trophimus the Ephesian with him in the city, and they supposed that Paul had brought him into the temple. See, that's how things get started, isn't it? You see somebody with somebody, you think, uh-oh, I know what's going on there. Then all the city was stirred up, and the people ran together. They seized Paul. And dragged him out of the temple, and at once the gates were shut. Well, it seems that the prophecy that he's been receiving from Asia Minor all the way over to the Phoenician coastline is now coming to pass. And as they were seeking to kill him, word came to the tribune of the cohort that all Jerusalem was in confusion. Now this is the authorities, and they're going to try to do something about it. He at once took soldiers and centurions and ran down to them, and when they saw the tribune and the soldiers, they stopped beating Paul. Then the tribune came up and arrested him and ordered him to be bound with two chains. He inquired who he was and what he had done. Some of the crowd were shouting one thing and some another, and as he could not learn the facts because of the uproar, he ordered him to be brought into the barracks. And when he came to the steps, he was actually carried by the soldiers because of the violence of the crowd. So he was bound, and he did have the Jews who, you know, they didn't technically turn him over, but he's now in Roman hands because of their activities. So the prophecy of Agabus is indeed coming about. For the mob of the people followed, crying out, "Away with him." Verse 37. As Paul was about to be brought into the barracks, he said to the tribune, "May I say something to you?" And he said, "Do you know Greek? Are you not the Egyptian?" Now see, they were under a mistaken notion too. Josephus tells us something about this particular Egyptian that's mentioned here in his Wars of the Jews, chapter 2. And in the paragraphs 261 through 263, this was a particular Jewish insurgent or insurgentist, or you want to call it, troublemaker, rabble rouser from Egypt who had come there, and he claimed to be a prophet, and he got a big following. But he goes on to describe it right here. We know from the description that he's talking about the same man that Josephus describes. He said, "Aren't you the Egyptian then who recently stirred up a revolt and led the 4,000 men of the assassins, literally dagger men, out into the wilderness?" Paul replied, "I am a Jew from Tarsus in Cilicia, a citizen of no obscure city. I beg you, permit me to speak to the people." And when he had given him permission, Paul, standing on the steps, motioned with his hand to the people. Now, we're not going to go into it today, but in chapter 22, we're going to see that he pulls the old citizenship card. So he's smart in the way he handles things, the language he uses, how he addresses the people. He knows his crowds. He's been in enough of them. And when he had given him permission, Paul, standing on the steps, motioned with his hand to the people, and when there was a great hush, he addressed them in, it says, in the Hebrew language. Now, it seems that in all probability that he's talking about, Luke is referring to the Aramaic language. Who were the Hebrew people? So it was the Jews. They spoke that the Aramaic was the common language of the Jews. So naturally it was called the Hebrew language. But it was not Hebrew itself. The priests and the Levites would have known Hebrew for sure. But a lot of the common people didn't they understood at Aramaic, which was significantly different from Hebrew. But he addressed them in the probably Aramaic language, saying, "Brothers and fathers, hear the defense that I now make before you." We'll hear that defense next time. We'll stop it there because we're already moving now into chapter 22. So we'll take it up chapter 22 next time I'm here.